The schoolroom. While Dr. Carey was making repairs on the car, Stuart went shopping. He decided that since he was about to take a long motor trip, he should have the proper clothes. He went to a doll shop where they had things which were the right size for him, and outfitted himself completely with new luggage, suits, shirts, and accessories. He charged everything and was well pleased with his purchases. That night he slept at the doctor's apartment. The next morning Stuart started early to avoid traffic. He thought it would be a good idea to get out on the road before there were too many cars and trucks. He drove through Central Park to 110th Street, then over to the West Side Highway, then north to the Sawmill River Parkway. The car ran beautifully, and although people were inclined to stare at him, Stuart didn't mind. He was very careful not to press the button which had caused so much trouble the day before. He made up his mind that he would never use that button again. Just as the sun was coming up, Stuart saw a man seated in thought by the side of the road. Stuart steered his car alongside, stopped, and put his head out. "You're worried about something, aren't you?" asked Stuart. "Yes, I am," said the man, who was tall and mild. "Can I help you in any way?" asked Stuart in a friendly voice. The man shook his head. "It's an impossible situation, I guess," he replied. "You see, I'm the superintendent of schools in this town." "That's not an impossible situation," said Stuart. "It's bad, but it's not impossible." "Well," continued the man, "I've always got problems that I can't solve. Today, for instance, one of my teachers is sick. Miss Gunderson is her name. She teaches number 7 school. I've got to find a substitute for her, a teacher who will take her place." "What's the matter with her?" asked Stuart. "I don't know exactly. The doctor says she may have rhinestones," replied the superintendent. "Can't you find another teacher?" asked Stuart. "No, that's the trouble. There's nobody in this town who knows anything. No spare teachers, no anything. School is supposed to begin in an hour."
"I will be glad to take Miss Gunderson's place for a day, if you would like," suggested Stuart agreeably. The superintendent of schools looked up.
"Really?"
"Certainly," said Stuart. "Glad to." He opened the door of his little car and stepped out. Walking around to the rear, he opened the baggage compartment and took out his suitcase.
"If I'm to conduct class in a schoolroom, I'd better take off these motoring togs and get into something more suitable," he said.
Stuart climbed the bank, went into the bushes, and was back in a few minutes wearing a pepper and salt jacket, old striped trousers, a Windsor tie, and spectacles. He folded his other clothes and packed them away in the suitcase.
"Do you think you can maintain discipline?" asked the superintendent.
"Of course I can," replied Stuart. "I'll make the work interesting, and the discipline will take care of itself. Don't worry about me." The man thanked him, and they shook hands. At 9:15, the scholars had gathered in school number 7. When they missed Miss Gunderson and word got round that there would be a substitute, they were delighted.
"A substitute," somebody whispered to somebody else. "A substitute, a substitute!"
The news traveled fast, and soon everyone in the schoolroom knew that they were all to have a rest from Miss Gunderson for at least a day, and were going to have the wonderful experience of being taught by a strange teacher whom nobody had ever seen before. Stuart arrived at 9. He parked his car briskly at the door of the school, stalked boldly into the room, found a yardstick leaning against Miss Gunderson's desk, and climbed hand over hand to the top. There he found an inkwell, a pointer, some pens and pencils, a bottle of ink, some chalk, a bell, 2 hairpins, and 3 or 4 books in a pile. Stuart scrambled nimbly up to the top of the stack of books and jumped for the button on the bell. His weight was enough to make it ring, and Stuart promptly slid down, walked to the front of the desk, and said, "Let me have your attention, please." The boys and girls crowded around the desk to look at the substitute. Everyone talked at once, and they seemed to be very much pleased. The girls giggled and the boys laughed, and everyone's eyes lit up with excitement to see such a small and good-looking teacher, so appropriately dressed.
"Let me have your attention, please," repeated Stuart. "As you know, Miss Gunderson is sick, and I am taking her place." "What's the matter with her?" asked Roy Hart eagerly.
"Vitamin trouble," replied Stuart. "She took vitamin D when she needed A. She took B when she was short of C. And her system became overloaded with the riboflavin, thiamine hydrochloride, and even with pyridoxin, the need for which in human nutrition has not been established.
Let it be a lesson for all of us." He glared fiercely at the children, and they made no more inquiries about Miss Gunderson. "Everyone will now take his or her seat," commanded Stuart. The pupils filed obediently down the aisles and dropped into their seats, and in a moment there was silence in the classroom. Stuart cleared his throat. Seizing a coat lapel in either hand to make himself look like a professor, Stuart began. "Anybody absent?" The scholars shook their heads. "Anybody late?" They shook their heads. "Very well," said Stuart. "What's the first subject you usually take up in the morning?" "Arithmetic," shouted the children. "Bother arithmetic," snapped Stuart. "Let's skip it." There were wild shouts of enthusiasm at this suggestion. Everyone in the class seemed perfectly willing to skip arithmetic for one morning. "What next do you study?" asked Stuart. "Spelling," cried the children. "Well," said Stuart, "a misspelled word is an abomination in the sight of everyone. I consider it a very fine thing to spell words correctly, and I strongly urge every one of you to buy a Webster's Collegiate Dictionary and consult it whenever you are in the slightest doubt. So much for spelling. What's next?" The scholars were just as pleased to be let out of spelling as they were about arithmetic, and they shouted for joy, and everybody looked at everybody else and laughed and waved handkerchiefs and rulers, and some of the boys threw spitballs at some of the girls. Stuart had to climb onto the pile of books again and dive for the bell to restore order. "What's next?" he repeated. "Writing," cried the scholars. "Goodness," said Stuart in disgust. "Don't you children know how to write yet?" "Certainly we do," yelled one and all. "So much for that, then," said Stuart.
"Social studies come next," cried Elizabeth Gardiner eagerly.
"Social studies? Never heard of them," said Stuart. "Instead of taking up any special subject this morning, why wouldn't it be a good idea if we just talked about something?" The scholars glanced around at each other in expectancy. "Could we talk about the way it feels to hold a snake in your hand and then it winds itself around your wrist?" asked Arthur Greenlaw. "We could, but I'd rather not," replied Stuart.
"Could we talk about sin and vice?" pleaded Lydia Lacey.
"Nope," said Stuart. "Try again."
"Could we talk about the fat woman at the circus, and she had hair all over her chin?" begged Isidore Feinberg reminiscently.
"No," said Stuart. "I'll tell you. Let's talk about the king of the world." He looked all around the room hopefully to see how the children liked that idea. "There isn't any king of the world," said Harry Jameson in disgust. "What's the diff?" said Stuart. "There ought to be one."
"Kings are old-fashioned," said Harry.
"Well, all right, then. Let's talk about the chairman of the world. The world gets into a lot of trouble because it has no chairman. I would like to be chairman of the world myself."
"You're too small," said Mary Bendix.
"Oh, fish feathers," said Stuart. "Size has nothing to do with it. It's temperament and ability that count. The chairman has to have ability, and he must know what's important. How many of you know what's important?" Up went all the hands. "Very good," said Stuart, cocking one leg across the other and shoving his hands in the pockets of his jacket. "Henry Rackmire, you tell us what is important."
"A shaft of sunlight at the end of a dark afternoon. A note in music, and the way the back of a baby's neck smells if its mother keeps it tidy," answered Henry.
"Correct," said Stuart. "Those are the important things. You forgot one thing, though. Mary Bendix, what did Henry Rackmire forget?"
"He forgot ice cream with chocolate sauce on it," said Mary quickly.
"Exactly," said Stuart. "Ice cream is important. Well, now, if I'm going to be chairman of the world this morning, we've got to have some rules. Otherwise it would be too confusing, with everyone running every which way and helping himself to things and nobody behaving. We've got to have some laws if we're going to play this game. Can anybody suggest any good laws for the world?" Albert Fernstrom raised his hand.
"Don't eat mushrooms, they might be toadstools," suggested Albert.
"That's not a law," said Stuart. "That's merely a bit of friendly advice. Very good advice, Albert, but advice and law are not the same. Law is much more solemn than advice. Law is extremely solemn. Anybody else think of a law for the world?"
"Necks on swiping anything," suggested John Poldovsky solemnly. Very good, said Stuart. Good law.
Never poison anything but rats, said Anthony Brindisi.
That's no good, said Stuart. It's unfair to rats. A law has to be fair to everybody.
Anthony looked sulky.
But rats are unfair to us, he said. Rats are objectionable.
I know they are, said Stuart. But from a rat's point of view, poison is objectionable. A chairman has to see all sides to a problem.
Have you got a rat's point of view? Asked Anthony. You look a little like a rat.
No, replied Stuart. I have more the point of view of a mouse, which is very different. I see things whole. It's obvious to me that rats are underprivileged. They've never been able to get out in the open.
Rats don't like the open, said Agnes Beretska.
That's because whenever they come out, somebody socks them. Rats might like the open if they were allowed to use it.
Any other ideas for laws?
Agnes Beretska raised her hand.
There ought to be a law against fighting.
Impractical, said Stuart. Men like to fight. But you're getting warm, Agnes.
No scrapping? Asked Agnes timidly.
Stuart shook his head.
Absolutely no being mean,
suggested Mildred Hoffenstein.
Very fine law, said Stuart. When I am chairman, anybody who is mean to anybody else is going to catch it.
That won't work, remarked Herbert Prendergast. Some people are just naturally mean. Albert Fernstrom is always being mean to me.
I'm not saying it'll work, said Stuart. It's a good law, and we'll give it a try.
We'll give it a try right here and now. Somebody do something mean to somebody. Harry Jameson, you be mean to Catherine Stableford. Wait a minute now. What's that you've got in your hand, Catherine?
It's a little tiny pillow stuffed with sweet balsam.
Does it say, for you I pine, for you I balsam on it?
Yes, said Catherine.
Do you love it very much? Asked Stuart.
Yes, I do, said Catherine.
Okay, Harry, grab it. Take it away.
Harry ran over to where Catherine sat, grabbed the little pillow from her hand, and ran back to his seat while Catherine screamed.
Now then, said Stuart in a fierce voice, hold on, my good people, while your chairman consults the Book of Rules.
He pretended to thumb through a book.
Here we are, page 492, absolutely no being mean. Page 560, nix on swiping anything.
Harry Jameson has broken two laws. The law against being mean and the law against swiping. Let's get Harry and set him back before he becomes so mean people will hardly recognize him anymore. Come on.
Stuart ran for the yardstick and slid down like a fireman coming down a pole in a firehouse.
He ran toward Harry, and the other children jumped up from their seats and raced up and down the aisles and crowded around Harry while Stuart demanded that he give up the little pillow. Harry looked frightened, although he knew it was just a test. He gave Catherine the pillow.
There! It worked pretty well, said Stuart. No being mean is a perfectly good law.
He wiped his face with his handkerchief, for he was quite warm from the exertion of being chairman of the world. It had taken more running and leaping and sliding than he had imagined. Catherine was very much pleased to have her pillow back.
Let's see that little pillow a minute, said Stuart, whose curiosity was beginning to get the better of him.
Catherine showed it to him. It was about as long as Stuart was high, and Stuart suddenly thought what a fine, sweet-smelling bed it would make for him. He began to want the pillow himself.
That's a very pretty thing, said Stuart, trying to hide his eagerness. You don't want to sell it, do you?
Oh, no, replied Catherine. It was a present to me.
I suppose it was given you by a boy you met at Lake Opatcong last summer, and it reminds you of him, murmured Stuart dreamily.
Yes, it was, said Catherine, blushing.
Ah, said Stuart, summers are wonderful, aren't they, Catherine?
Yes, and last summer was the most wonderful summer I have ever had in all my life.
I can imagine, replied Stuart. You're sure you wouldn't want to sell that little pillow?
Catherine shook her head.
Don't know as I blame you, replied Stuart quietly. Summertime is important. It's like a shaft of sunlight.
Or a note in music, said Elizabeth Atchison.
Or the way the back of a baby's neck smells, if its mother keeps it tidy, said Marilyn Roberts.
Stuart sighed. Never forget your summer times, my dears, he said. Well, I've got to be getting along. It's been a pleasure to know you all. Class is dismissed.
Stuart strode rapidly to the door, climbed into the car, and with a final wave of the hand drove off in a northerly direction, while the children raced alongside and screamed,
Goodbye,
Goodbye! Goodbye!
They all wished they could have a substitute every day instead of Miss Gunderson. Ames Crossing. In the loveliest town of all, where the houses were white and high, and the elm trees were green and higher than the houses, where the front yards were wide and pleasant, and the backyards were bushy and worth finding out about, where the streets sloped down to the stream, and the stream flowed quietly under the bridge, where the lawns ended in orchards, and the orchards ended in fields, and the fields ended in pastures, and the pastures climbed the hill and disappeared over the top toward the wonderful wide sky. In this loveliest of all towns, Stuart stopped to get a drink of sarsaparilla. Parking his car in front of the general store, he stepped out and the sun felt so good that he sat down on the porch for a few moments to enjoy the feeling of being in a new place on a fine day. This was the most peaceful and beautiful spot he had found in all his travels. It seemed to him a place he would gladly spend the rest of his life in, if it weren't that he might get homesick for the sights of New York and for his family, Mr. and Mrs. Frederick C. Little and George, and if it weren't for the fact that something deep inside him made him want to find Margot. After a while, the storekeeper came out to smoke a cigarette, and he joined Stuart on the front steps. He started to offer Stuart a cigarette, but when he noticed how small he was, he changed his mind. "Have you any sarsaparilla in your store?" asked Stuart. "I've got a ruinous thirst." "Certainly," said the storekeeper. "Gallons of it. Sarsaparilla, root beer, birch beer, ginger ale, moxie, lemon soda, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Dipsy-Cola, Pipsy-Cola, Popsy-Cola, and raspberry cream tonic. Anything you want." "Let me have a bottle of sarsaparilla, please," said Stuart, "and a paper cup." The storekeeper went back into the store and returned with a drink. He opened the bottle, poured some out into the cup, and set the cup down on the step below Stuart, who whipped off his cap, lay down on his stomach, and dipped up some of the cool, refreshing drink, using his cap as a dipper. "That's very refreshing," remarked Stuart. "There's nothing like a long, cool drink in the heat of the day when you're traveling."
"You going far?" asked the storekeeper.
"Perhaps very far," replied Stuart. "I'm looking for a bird named Margot. You haven't sighted her, have you?"
"Can't say I have," said the storekeeper. "What does she look like?"
"Perfectly beautiful," replied Stuart, wiping the sarsaparilla off his lips with a corner of his sleeve. "She's a remarkable bird. Anybody would notice her. She comes from a place where there are thistles." The storekeeper looked at Stuart closely.
"How tall are you?" he asked.
"You mean in my stocking feet?" said Stuart.
"Yes."
2 inches nothing and a quarter," answered Stuart. "I haven't been measured recently, however. I may have shot up a bit."
"You know," said the storekeeper thoughtfully, "there's somebody in this town you really ought to meet."
Who's that?"
asked Stuart, yawning.
"Harriet Ames," said the storekeeper. "She's just your size. Maybe a trifle shorter, if anything."
"What's she like?" asked Stuart.
"Fair, fat, and 40?"
"No. Harriet is young, and she's quite pretty. She's considered one of the best-dressed girls in this town, too. All her clothes are tailored specially for her."
"That's so," remarked Stuart.
"Yes, Harriet's quite a girl. Her people, the Ameses, are rather prominent in this town. One of her ancestors used to be the ferryman here in the Revolutionary days. He would carry anybody across the stream. He didn't care whether they were British soldiers or American soldiers, as long as they paid their fare. I guess he did pretty well. Anyway, the Ameses have always had plenty of money. They live in a big house with a lot of servants. I know Harriet would be very much interested to meet you."
"That's very kind of you," replied Stuart. "But I'm not much of a society man these days. Too much on the move. I never stay long anywhere. I blow into town and blow right out again, here today, gone tomorrow. A will-o'-the-wisp. The highways and byways are where you'll find me, always looking for Margot. Sometimes I feel that I'm quite near to her, and that she's just around the turn of the road. Other times I feel that I'll never find her again and never hear her voice again. Which reminds me, it's time I was on my way."
Stuart paid for his drink and said goodbye to the storekeeper and drove off. But Ames Crossing seemed like the finest town he had ever known, and before he reached the end of the main street he swerved sharp left, turned off onto a dirt road, and drove down to a quiet spot on the bank of the river. That afternoon he swam and lay on his back on the mossy bank,
his hands crossed under his head, his thoughts returning to the conversation he had had with the storekeeper. "Harriet Ames," he murmured. Evening came, and Stuart still lingered by the stream. He ate a light supper of a cheese sandwich and a drink of water, and slept that night in the warm grass with the sound of the stream in his ears. In the morning the sun rose warm and bright, and Stuart slipped into the river again for an early dip. After breakfast he left his car hidden under a skunk cabbage leaf and walked up to the post office. While he was filling his fountain pen from the public inkwell, he happened to glance toward the door, and what he saw startled him so that he almost lost his balance and fell into the ink. A girl about 2 inches high had entered and was crossing the floor toward the mailboxes. She wore sports clothes and walked with her head held high. In her hair was a stamen from a flower. Stuart began to tremble from excitement. "Must be the Ames girl," he said to himself, and he kept out of sight behind the inkwell as he watched her open her mailbox, which was about 1/4 inch wide, and pull out her letters. The storekeeper had told the truth. Harriet was pretty. And, of course, she was the only girl Stuart had ever encountered who wasn't miles and miles taller than he was. Stuart figured that if the two of them were to walk along together, her head would come a little higher than his shoulder. The idea filled him with interest. He wanted to slide down to the floor and speak to her, but he didn't dare. All his boldness had left him, and he stayed hidden behind the inkwell until Harriet had gone. When he was sure that she was out of sight, he stole out of the post office and slunk down the street to the store, half hoping that he would meet the beautiful little girl, half fearing that he would. "Have you any engraved stationery?" he asked the storekeeper. "I'm behind on my correspondence." The storekeeper helped Stuart up onto the counter and found some letter paper for him, small paper marked with the initial L. Stuart whipped out his fountain pen and sat down against a 5-cent candy bar and began a letter to Harriet. "My dear Miss Ames," he wrote, "I am a young person of modest proportions. By birth, I am a New Yorker, but at the moment I am traveling on business of a confidential nature. My travels have brought me to your village. Yesterday, the keeper of your local store, who has an honest face and an open manner, gave me a most favorable report of your character and appearance." At this point in the letter, Stuart's pen ran dry from the long words, and Stuart had to get the storekeeper to lower him headfirst into a bottle of ink so that he could refill the pen. Then he went back to letter writing. "Pray forgive me, Miss Ames," continued Stuart, "for presuming to strike up an acquaintance on so slender an excuse as our physical similarity. But of course the fact is, as you yourself must know, there are very few people who are only 2 inches in height. I say 2 inches. Actually, I am somewhat taller than that. My only drawback is that I look something like a mouse. I am nicely proportioned, however, am also muscular beyond my years. Let me be perfectly blunt. My purpose in writing this brief note is to suggest that we meet. I realize that your parents may object to the suddenness and directness of my proposal, as well as to my somewhat mouse-like appearance, so I think probably it might be a good idea if you just didn't mention the matter to them. What they don't know won't hurt them. However, you probably understand more about your dealing with your father and mother than I do, so I won't attempt to instruct you, but will leave everything to your good judgment. Being an outdoors person, I am camped by the river in an attractive spot at the foot of Tracy's Lane. Would you care to go for a paddle with me in my canoe? How about tomorrow afternoon towards sundown, when the petty annoyances of the day are behind us, and the river seems to flow more quietly in the long shadows of the willows? These tranquil spring evenings are designed by special architects for the enjoyment of the boatmen. I love the water, dear Miss Ames, and my canoe is like an old and trusted friend." Stuart forgot in the excitement of writing Harriet that he did not own a canoe. "If you wish to accept my invitation, be at the river tomorrow about 5 o'clock. I shall await your arrival with all the eagerness I can muster. And now I must close this offensive letter and catch up with my affairs. Yours very truly, Stuart Little." After Stuart had sealed his letter in an envelope, he turned to the storekeeper. "Where can I get hold of a canoe?" he asked. "Right here," replied the storekeeper. He walked over to his souvenir counter and took down a little birch-bark canoe with the words "Summer Memories" stamped on the side. Stuart examined it closely. "Does she leak?" asked Stuart. "It's a nice canoe." replied the storekeeper, bending it gently back into shape with his fingers. "It will cost you 75 cents plus a penny tax." Stuart took out his money and paid the man. Then he looked inside the canoe and noticed that there were no paddles. "What about paddles?" he said, making his voice sound businesslike. The storekeeper hunted around among the souvenirs, but he couldn't seem to find any paddles, so he went over to the ice cream counter and came back with two little cardboard spoons, the kind you use for eating ice cream on picnics. "These will work out all right as paddles," he said. Stuart took the spoons, but he was disgusted with the looks of them. "They may work out all right," said Stuart, "but I would hate to meet an American Indian while I had one of these things in my hand." The storekeeper carried the canoe and the paddles out in the front of the store and set them down in the street. He wondered what this tiny boatman would do next, but Stuart never hesitated. Taking a piece of thread from his pocket, he lashed the paddles to the thwarts, swung the canoe lightly up on his head, and walked off with it as calmly as though he were a Canadian guide. He was very proud of his ability with boats, and he liked to show off.